We need never be grateful enough to the earth, which has given us everything. Coming home to her, we come home to ourselves.
Okay, so this is, today's an Earth Day service. And as a special treat for Earth Day, I'm going to read Wallace Stevens' poem, Sunday Morning. If you're not too poetry-oriented, you might not know that Wallace Stevens was born in 1880 in Pennsylvania, and his father was a town lawyer. He went to Harvard and became a lawyer himself, and moved to Hartford, where he lived for most of his life and was in charge of settling large claims for the Hartford Insurance Company. And that meant that he could completely separate his art from his work life, which, as you probably would all agree, that settling insurance claims does not seem to be a very poetic activity. So, Sunday Morning was written in 1916, and it's a poem that proceeds by association without much narrative, and so you have to kind of let it just flow through. It begins with a woman sitting on Sunday morning at home, and she didn't go to church that day, so that's the situation. Sunday morning. Complacencies of the peignoir and late coffee and oranges in a sunny chair, and the green freedom of a cockatoo upon a rug, mingle to dissipate the holy hush of ancient sacrifice. She dreams a little, and she feels the dark encroachment of that old catastrophe as a calm darkens among water lights. The pungent oranges and bright green wings seem things in some procession of the dead, winding across wide water without sound. The day is like wide water without sound. Still, for the passing of her dreaming feet over the seas to silent Palestine, dominion of the blood and sepulchre. Why should she give her bounty to the dead? What is divinity if it can come only in silent shadows and in dreams? Shall she not find in comforts of the sun, in pungent fruit and bright green wings, or else in any balm or beauty of the earth, things to be cherished like the thought of heaven? Divinity must live within herself. Passions of rain or moods in falling snow, grievings in loneliness or unsubdued elations when the forest blooms, gusty emotions on wet roads on autumn nights, all pleasures and all pains, remembering the bough of summer and the winter branch, these are the measures destined for her soul. Jove in the clouds had his inhuman birth. No mother suckled him, no sweet land gave large-mannered motions to his mythy mind. He moved among us as a muttering king magnificent would move among his hinds, until our blood, commingling virginal with heaven, brought such requital to desire, the very hinds discerned it in a star. Shall our blood fail, or shall it come to be the blood of paradise? And shall the earth seem all a paradise that we shall know? The sky will be much friendlier then than now, a part of labor and a part of pain, and next in glory to enduring love, not this dividing and indifferent blue. She says, I am content when wakened birds before they fly test the reality of misty fields by their sweet questionings. But when the birds are gone, and their warm fields return no more, where then is paradise? There is not any haunt of prophecy, nor any old chimera of the grave, neither the golden underground, nor isle melodious where spirits got them home, nor visionary south, nor cloudy palm remote on heaven's hill, that has endured as April's green endures, or will endure, like her remembrance of awakened birds, or her desire for June and evening, tipped by the consummation of the swallow's wings. She says, but in contentment, I still feel the need of some imperishable bliss. Death is the mother of beauty. Hence from her alone shall come fulfillment to our dreams and our desires. Although she strews the leaves of sure obliteration on our paths, the path sick sorrow took, the many paths where triumph rang its brassy phrase, or love whispered a little out of tenderness, she makes the willow shiver in the sun for maidens who were wont to sit and gaze upon the grass relinquished to their feet. She causes boys to pile new plums and pears on disregarded plate. The maidens taste and stray impassioned in the littering leaves. Is there no change of death in paradise? Does ripe fruit never fall? Or do the boughs hang always heavy in that perfect sky, unchanging, yet so like our perishing earth, with rivers like our own that seek for seas they never find, the same receding shores they never touch with inarticulate pang? Why set the pear upon those river banks, or spice the shores with odors of the plum? Alas, that they should wear our colors there, the silken weavings of our afternoons, and pick the strings of our insipid lutes. Death is the mother of beauty mystical, within whose burning bosom we devise our earthly mothers waiting sleeplessly. Supple and turbulent, a ring of men shall chant in orgy on a summer morn their boisterous devotion to the sun, not as a god, but as a god might be, naked among them like a savage source. Their chant shall be a chant of paradise, out of their blood returning to the sky. And in their chant shall enter voice by voice the windy lake wherein their Lord delights, the trees like seraphim, and echoing hills that choir among themselves long afterward. They shall know well the heavenly fellowship of men that perish and of summer morn, and whence they came and whither they shall go, the dew upon their feet shall manifest. She hears upon that water without sound a voice that cries, the tomb in Palestine is not the porch of spirits lingering. It is the grave of Jesus where he lay. We live in an old chaos of the sun, or old dependency of day and night, or island solitude, unsponsored, free of that wide water, inescapable. Deer walk upon our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness, and in the isolation of the sky at evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings. The air today is not the best, I don't think. My throat is a little bit clogged up, so let's hope my voice holds out. You may have noticed that I enjoy throwing the occasional curveball, and so if somebody wants to hit it out of the park, that's their business. So I wanted to talk about Jesus because there's not a lot of talk about Jesus probably here in our society. Occasionally his name does come up. But I don't think that we can completely dispense with this aspect of our tradition. And so I'm going to give an interpretation that is probably influenced by the idea that many times there are repressed elements that are buried in a text. In other words, that we can't take something necessarily at face value because something is being deliberately covered up or forgotten. And so if I would suggest that if this is something you are interested in, You might want to read through the Gospel of Mark at a sitting, and then ideally do it again the next several days, and try to set aside your presumption about what's happening here, and see the dramatic way in which Jesus is interacting with various groups. And I will indicate here what some things that have come out of this for me. The topic is taboo and release. In the Gospels, Jesus is presented again and again as a violator of taboos. It is as if he is reversing the polarity of the entire social field, the codes governing contamination, contagion, and filth. For example, he puts out his hand and touches a leper, a source of pollution. But instead of becoming corrupted himself, as the norms of his time stipulate, the leper becomes clean. Similarly, there is the story of the woman who had had an issue of blood for 12 years, evidently what might today be called menstrual difficulties. A menstruating woman was a source of contamination. So when she reached out and touched Jesus, she was violating the code which required her to refrain from touching of this sort. And again, instead of contaminating Jesus, power goes out of the Messiah's body and she is healed of her infirmity. She is restored to health and normal sexual and reproductive function. You remember that, how Jesus said, "Who touched me?" And the whole crowd was, you know, they were crowding in on him. And the disciples said, What's the matter with you? Everybody's crowding on you. He said, "I know, but I felt power go out." So then another story that has a similar meaning, perhaps, is the story about the daughter of Jairus. Jairus was the president of a synagogue. He was a notable. And he comes and says, "My daughter's sick, please come." And then while they're going, the daughter dies and the people are all mourning. And Jesus takes her by the hand and bids her rise. Now, one does not touch corpses lightly, as they are a source of pollution. Only persons who are specially designated and qualified may handle the dead. Death, in fact, is the ultimate source of pollution and impurity. So when she returns to life, Jesus says, "Give her something to eat." So she's restored to the blessings of the table. Her body will again receive nourishment from the fruits of the earth given by God. Further, we are told she was about 12 years old. That is, she was at the age of puberty and marriageability. So she too recovers her sexuality, a part of the grace of life given by God. Now, these miracles symbolize the dynamic character of Jesus' activity, which also appears in another form, his table fellowship. The kingdom of God is somewhat unfortunate translation, because the term actually refers to the active creative power of God. It means God acting. It doesn't mean a domain like a geographical region. It's active rather than just the sort of stable container or something. So the active creative power that made the universe breaks out in the middle of history, in secular time, not only through the miracles of the Messiah, but also through this table fellowship in which, once again, the clean and the unclean touch with an effect, which is the reverse of what would reasonably have been expected. The unclean become clean because they are sitting at table with the Messiah. They have his real body, his human body present with them. Power, mana, charisma. There is an energy which streams from the Messiah's body, which is strong enough to reverse the usual polarities. Not only are the tax collectors and prostitutes and lower class people and peasants, none of whom have the time or money to maintain themselves in a state of ritual purity, not only do these now become charged with a new life, but those who are considered the pure, the good people, the religious people, are now shown up to be on the side of the Satan, the adversary of God, the enemies ultimately of life. This is a pretty major reversal that's happening here. There must be something very powerful going on to do that. So these scribes and Pharisees are on the side of death and corruption, it turns out. The temple, where the system of meanings, the codes, centers, amazingly enough, was a social and religious device through which money was made to flow uphill. You remember about driving this, the money changers out. This was not a small thing. This was major. The chief priests were the rich aristocrats who basically controlled the trade there. And so you had the poor people coming and buying for sacrifices. And a huge amount of people actually were involved in living from this sort of thing. Then the story is that the scribes and the Pharisees opposed Jesus when he healed someone on the Sabbath. They consider that a form of work that one must not do. But Jesus says, no, this work is the work of God. This work of healing is a sign that the active reign or kingship of God is breaking in. The power that made the universe is breaking in right here, and that's why this person has been healed. And tell me, is it all right to do good on the Sabbath or not? They didn't know what to say. The text says they were silent. They didn't know what to say. Then there was an immoral woman one time who came into the dining room of a fine, upstanding Christian gentleman. I mean, Pharisee gentleman. And anoints Jesus' feet with ointment, wipes them with her hair, and weeps profusely as she does so. In a parallel version of the story, she simply washes his feet with her tears. To my mind, this is an outrageously erotic scene. Very little commented on. But if you just think about what you would do if you were going to film this and what the emotion would be. So the Pharisee, meanwhile, has shown himself in the wrong from the outset because he failed to provide the minimal hospitality of washing Jesus' feet. And this woman has corrected his oversight. She is clean by virtue of her contact with Jesus, while Simon the Pharisee has been caught out in a flagrant lapse of hospitality, interestingly enough, one that is related to an issue of cleanliness. And Jesus himself points out that this woman has shown a proper regard and care for the body of the Messiah. She perceives correctly the dynamic healing power that emanates from this body. While the Pharisee, caught in the codes of normal society, cannot perceive him. Returning then to the matter of the table fellowship, which was perhaps the central scandal, Jesus ate with sinners. This was one of the primary accusations against him. Besides that, he was no ascetic. He ate and he drank. And they said, a glutton, a drunkard. When John ate, you know, locust and wild honey, they said, he's a madman. So anyway, here's this living community, already fully real and functional. And this is before the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. The Christian religion does not exist as yet. Jesus has broken the taboos which outlaw table fellowship between people who are different, who do not hold to the same customs. He enjoys fellowship and friendship with aliens and outsiders, lowlife even. He is overturning the order of society. He is doing that which is not done. And amazingly, from this violation of the taboos comes a flow of power, an energy charge, which goes out into the social system, shaking it to its core. The legitimacy of the powers that be becomes questionable in the eyes of the people. This is a serious threat. And so you have the adversaries always, again and again, trying to catch him in a trap so that they will later be able to accuse him, as in fact, of course, they do. Well, you might be wondering what this has to do with Earth Day. I think it has quite a lot to do with it, actually. Because the table fellowship, in a sense, had nothing to do with religion. In fact, it was perceived as a blasphemous attack on religion. The religious people saw it like that. They didn't have any violin music, you know what I mean? So what was really happening? Jesus had reintroduced the social practice long forgotten in the cosmopolitan world of the Roman Empire, namely the gift economy. The gift economy works well in tribal societies, but in the modern world of empire and long-distance trade, in a world of displaced people and refugees, in such a world one hangs on to one's ethnic and racial and religious identity for dear life, also one's property, one's money, one's professional privileges. Yet Jesus opens all the windows and all the doors and invites all comers to his table, and this is not a religious ceremony. It undermines religion because the new community finds its identity not in the codes of society with its classes and hierarchies, but rather in the fundamental gift of life. We have all received our lives through no merit or accomplishment of our own, nor through whatever status we may have in society. The gift of life is more fundamental than anything we may do with it after we have received it. And so what is happening is he is calling together the diversity of people. You know, in bioregionalism, we say, let's live in place. Well, tribal people lived in place. But we aren't members of tribes. We're all mixed up in this, you know, cosmopolitan world. There's no thought here, let's go back and reclaim our tribal identity. That is gone. It's history. It's not even history. We don't even remember it. And so, in such a world, Jesus is constituting a new community out of this mixture. And, you know, if you read the codes of the Levitical code, the priestly code in the Old Testament, you see there is a horror of mixing. Thou shalt not boil the kid in its mother's milk, because that would be mixing dairy and milk. And you can't
meat.
Pardon?
Dairy and meat.
And meat, I'm sorry. And there's various other things where you see there are categories, in other words, which seem to be, in a sense, natural to the mind, at least at that time. And mixing those categories is what is horrifying. And so here's Jesus sort of mixing people together in a way which was obviously horrifying to those who followed the religious and ceremonial codes and the social coach. So I think there's a very great relevance to our situation in which we face multiple crises, particularly as related to the earth and the future of the earth, and we're pulverized. So the possibility of reconstituting a new community in this situation is very relevant. Now, those who become conscious of this fact, that the gift of life is more fundamental than anything that we do with our lives, will live with an attitude of gratitude. That's a very simple, if not simple-minded, definition of faith, attitude of gratitude. As they extend the right hand of fellowship and welcome to all whose hearts resonate to this same note of gratitude for the sheer gift of existence, to be alive on this earth, to see the sun, to eat, to drink, to embrace. This is all just too much. Having received so much, the standards of who is important people and who not lose all meaning. And of course, this is what happens to virtually, you can see this in the stories of all these people that are just flabbergasted that Jesus has offered them this kind of acceptance and welcome, which should not have been at all. After all, he was a rabbi, at least in the popular mind. And so there's this sense of gratitude which relativizes all the standards of society. What abundance on the table of life. And so it turns out that the body of the Messiah is in reality the body of the fellowship at table. Jesus is only the hero who embodies and symbolizes the joyous exuberance and power of this experience of being here together, all undeserving recipients of the fundamental gift of life. There is no need for all to be sickly or with the pale cast of thought or of religion in its usual sense. The table fellowship, based on the violation of taboos, is the real miracle and the real scandal. The relevance of this to Earth Day is immediately apparent if we simply substitute the word earth for the word God. We are all children of the earth. There's nothing religious about it. It is simply fact. Who can deny it? And today the earth is under threat. Our species is under threat because of what we are doing to the earth. Where will we find the soul force to deal with these things which are too depressing to think about? Unless we find it in our hearts to create a new community, we will not have the wherewithal to address the situation. We will not be able to make the transition to the ecozoic era, as called for by Thomas Berry, unless we discover the gift character of our lives on this earth, and thus participate in the emergence of a new community. The discovery that one's life is a gift, utterly unmerited and gratuitous, releases energy and love. One begins to live out of an attitude of gratitude. We can never be grateful enough to the earth, which has given us everything. So said Constantin Brancusi, the Romanian sculptor. Some of his work is in the Yale Art Gallery, a 20th century artist. Because of the threat to the earth, and to the community of life which exists in our time, all people everywhere are coming into a common fate. There is a new possibility of recognizing that all are children of the one earth. There is a possibility of realizing that we all participate in a common species identity. Gratitude to the earth may now issue into a new passion for the earth as the source of life, a passion that might unite all humans potentially in the creation of a new culture. Human ingenuity and cleverness are not the source of our lives, ultimately. But the creation of a new culture is a great work, which will require of us all that we have. We humans will have to accept a position second to the community of life as a whole. When all come together without distinctions around the table of the earth in an attitude of gratitude, there will be a release of power similar to what is depicted in the Gospels, depicted for those who can read between the lines, since what happened was already being repressed and covered over by the time the Gospels were being written. Sheer gratitude for life was already becoming taboo again. Already life was ceasing to be the justification for everything else, and a new system was coming into being in which it was life that required justification. Already the fundamental gift uncovered by Jesus' taboo-violating activity was being repressed. Already, just being alive, the glory of life on this earth was becoming the dirty thing that had to be cleaned up by new rules, new theories, and new classes of experts. Already, another world above and beyond this one here was needed to justify the earth. Under the pressure of our present crisis, a crisis which will shake the foundations of society, there so deeply require and for which we long. Well, I think we have time for me to read one little short poem by Stanley Kuntz. Stanley died recently at the age of 98. And I heard a tape of him when he was 96 at the Chautauqua Institution. And he was just putting forth with full vigor at age 96. This is a poem called The Long Boat. He spent quite a bit of time at Cape Cod in the summer. When his boat snapped loose from its mooring under the screeching of the gulls, he tried at first to wave to his dear ones on shore, but in the rolling fog they had already lost their faces. Too tired even to choose between jumping and calling, somehow he felt absolved and free of his burdens, those mottos stamped on his name tag, conscience, ambition, and all that caring. He was content to lie down with the family ghost in the slop of his cradle, buffeted by the storm, endlessly drifting. Peace, peace to be rocked by the infinite, as if it didn't matter which way was home. As if he didn't know, he loved the earth so much, he wanted to stay forever.
As we leave this place and go about our separate affairs, let us remain ever mindful of the great depths that are all about us.